From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, well, it's time to talk about chemtrails, and that's what we shall do here on Coast to Coast AM. Here's what's happening. Well, first and foremost, in Sydney, Australia, before he was killed in a Sydney, Australia cafe, the gunman who held hostages there for more than 16 hours was apparently no stranger to police at all. The hostage taker was Manharon Monas. He had a long history of violent crime, infatuation with extremism, and mental instability, according to the Australian Prime Minister. Australian media reports painting a picture of him as he had a lengthy criminal history. He was a self-styled cleric. He pleaded guilty last year to writing offensive letters to the families of Australian troops. Now, what's the significance of this story? One, it happened in Australia, where they don't have a lot of terrorist acts. But two, can it happen here? Police in Pennsylvania mounting an intense search in the Philadelphia suburbs for a man suspected of killing his ex-wife and five former in-laws. Bradley William Stone of Pennsburg is accused of killing his ex-wife and her mother, grandmother, and sister, as well as her sister's husband and 14-year-old daughter. Stone didn't harm his own daughters. They were living with the ex-wife. He took them to a neighbor's residence. It was the last place he was seen. The families of nine of the 26 people killed and a teacher wounded 2 years ago at the Sandy Hook Elementary School have filed a lawsuit against the manufacturer, distributor, and seller of the rifle used in the shooting. They claim the negligence and wrongful death lawsuit filed in the Bridgeport Superior Court asserts that the Bushmaster AR-15 rifle should not have been made publicly available because it was designed for military use and is unsuited, they say, for hunting or home defense. Why all this violence? Let's check in with resident psychiatrist Peter Breggin on this story. Peter, there's so much violence going on these days. What's happening? I mean, why are people doing this? I mean, a guy killing all these people, he's upset. What's going on, Peter?
Well, we've got so many different kinds of violence going on that I think it's, you know, we got to just take a look at a number of the different ones that are going on. The Australian shooting is part of a pattern that we're going to see increasing because it's being inspired, you know, by radical Muslim attacks on anybody, including often, you know, different sects in their own religion. So that people who are disturbed and angry, or people who are looking for an ideology or looking for a way to get even, are going to pile into that area. And I was talking with Ginger about this just before the show, and I used the term that so many of these are lone wolves that we're seeing, and she said,
yes,
there aren't any lone wolves. He said, these people are on the Internet. There's no more lone wolves than the pedophiles are lone wolves anymore. There's so much activity on the Internet. There's such availability. And then we have the school shootings, which you also mentioned in the intro. And they're another group that's being inspired in a similar fashion, trying to put some things together, by the Internet, by media glorification. So the individual shooter in a school now has been online talking with other angry young people, playing computer games, you know, about how many people can you kill.
So
we've got these two different kinds of cultures of violence that are stimulating a lot of violence. One is the fundamentally religious war we're in, not religious from our viewpoint, but from the radical Muslims, and the way they're going to be inspiring more and more people looking for an outlet, looking for an ideology, looking for a cult experience. And then we've got the young school shooters who are really, have been introduced to this whole new culture of killing that, as I mentioned on one of our earlier shows, that we just didn't have when I was growing up. Nobody thought of killing people because they were humiliated in school or angry or lost their girlfriend. I don't know how we can go about this other than on a cultural level in our country. Got to find a way to report news and have movies and have freedom of the press without inspiring so much violence.
Oh, it's crazy, Peter. And by the way, I got a lot of emails from our show, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, your latest book. And I wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, I wanted to thank you. Aside just from the book, I had such a wonderful time talking with you and talking with your audience, and I got a huge amount of feedback as well. I'll tell you, I put such value on our conversations and so much appreciate doing it. I sure wish I had a better, easier answers around this subject of violence that you brought up.
I wish you had like a magic wand, Peter, that you could just wave over everybody. But I know you can't do that. Just way too much violence. You know, you listen to this, Peter. If you've already bought tickets for Super Bowl 49 or you're looking forward to watching it with your family and friends on television, you may be surprised to learn that there's a chance it might even be played. I'm kidding you not. Congress first needs to make a decision on renewing a piece of legislation that you possibly never heard of. It's called the TRIA, the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act. TRIA was signed into law back in 2002 after the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, establishing a risk-sharing partnership between the federal government and the insurance industry that made terrorism insurance widely available to U.S. businesses, and among them, organizers of sporting events. Without federal support, they say, most insurers had been unwilling to offer coverage. TRIA was renewed in 2005 and 2007. It is set to expire on December 31st, unless Congress renews it. With 2 weeks until the deadline, the clock is ticking. Isn't that strange? OPEC will stand by its decision not to cut output, even if oil prices fall as low as $40 a barrel, and will wait at least 3 months before considering an emergency meeting, according to the United Arab Emirates Energy Minister. Jerry Corsi, of course, author of Black Gold Stranglehold. This is an incredible story, Jerry. How low can it go?
Well, I think, George, clearly oil is going to challenge $50 a barrel on Brent crude, and already is trading just for crude oil below $50 a barrel in various markets around the world. I think $50 is going to be a price support right now. I mean, when we wrote Black Gold Stranglehold, remember in 2005, oil was trading at $40 a barrel.
That's right. And
we predicted $100 a barrel, and everyone thought we were crazy. We got excoriated for saying oil could go as high as $100 a barrel in 2005. Well, today I think oil is going to challenge $50 a barrel, and it's going to cause major political disruptions. You're already seeing it in Russia.
Well, and maybe they want this to happen, Jerry. Maybe they want to crush, like the ruble is falling to the dollar. It's plummeting.
Well, there's certainly a political strategy. I mean, President Reagan used the reductions in the price of oil down to, I believe, in the 20s, $20 a barrel, to bring down the Soviet Union. And clearly it's a political strategy with Russia in the Ukraine. Also, in combination with our sanctions that we've recently reaffirmed against Russia and Ukraine, the falling price of oil is a major political pressure. Russia has now gone to 17% interest in an attempt to support the ruble. And I think that's going to be a very difficult battle to win. The dollar is actually gaining in strength, and the United States has the potential, if we would just allow our oil to be exported, to really, again, resume number one position worldwide as an exporter of oil, which, of course, the peak oil theorist, now largely discredited,
yes,
thought was impossible a few years ago.
Well, you and I have always been abiotic oil theorists, Jerry, and it looks like we were right, huh?
Well, I think, George, I believe that it's going to be increasingly clear that oil is an abiotic natural product of the earth, and it's plentiful. I've said repeatedly, oil is going to be, in the future, a more available product than fresh water. Fresh water is going to be scarce. Oil is going to be plentiful. It has always been plentiful if we just get the politics out of the way of allowing production.
Good point. Jerry, thanks so much. Talk to you soon. the craze, Elf on a Shelf. As a matter of fact, a couple of my grandchildren are living in the house in St. Louis. They're 4 and 3, and every morning their mother has the little elf sitting around somewhere, and they've got to find him, and then, of course, the elf reports back to Santa on how they're doing. It's a craze that's been going on for several years now, and it's amazing. But some people say, could it be something a little more sinister than the little elf sitting on the shelf, returning to the North Pole each night with his report? Well, according to Laura Pinto, a digital technology professor at the University of Ontario's Institute of Technology, who was almost on the show tonight, she got a splitting headache, so she couldn't do it, but she has recently published a paper titled Who's the Boss?, saying that the idea of it reporting back to Santa each night on the child's behavior sets up the children for dangerous, uncritical acceptance of power structures. Well, I'm going to try to get Laura back on the show to explain that. But so the next time you set up the little elf on a shelf, just remember that. Listen to this. A Mexican pilot is out of a job. What did he do? Well, there was a gorgeous singer sitting on the plane with her actress friend, so he invited them into the cockpit area to fly the plane. Well, they fired him for that. And a woman in Saudi Arabia has been arrested while attending a soccer game in the kingdom there. Apparently, she did not know that women were prohibited from going to the male-only stadiums. Unbelievable. And in a moment, we talk about hemp. What's going on there? Christopher Boucher joins me next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast for a couple hours. We're going to talk about a subject that's pretty important that is really not looked at by the mainstream media. First of all, let me tell you about our guest. Christopher Boucher is one of America's pioneers in the modern USA hemp industry. He currently serves as vice president of product development at Cannavest Corporation in San Diego. Founder of the Hemp Industries Association back in 1992. A couple years later, he became the first person in more than 50 years to grow industrial hemp in the United States. And by the way, in the past, it was used a lot. We'll tell you why and how. He, Mr. Boucher, co-wrote the first California and Colorado Industrial Hemp Legislation Act back in 95. He serves as the boilerplate for most state legislation regarding industrial hemp. Here's Christopher Boucher on Coast to Coast. Hey, Chris, good to have you.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be here, George.
Let's go back, way back. Tell me about hemp and how much it was used back in the United States days.
Well, we can go back to the Ice Age. It's one of the few plants that survived the Ice Age. It's known to the germplasm is to break the permafrost. It basically has survived. We've used it for over 10,000 years. I always like to say hemp is more American than apple pie when you look at just what it's done for this country. This country wouldn't have been discovered if it wasn't for hemp. Every ship, every boat that crossed the ocean from the Cortez to Christopher Columbus, the Mayflower, all those ships had hemp ropes, hemp sails, hemp oakum. They weren't made out of cotton. They weren't made out of flax. So you got to understand how important hemp was for the economy, for merchants. It was the fuel of that era.
It wasn't hemp also like used for paper products? It just about everything.
Yeah, all your first Gutenberg Bibles were printed on hemp. So for hundreds of years, all Bibles were made out of hemp paper.
Christopher, tell me about the plant itself. How does it look, and how would you compare it to cannabis, marijuana?
Okay, that's a good question. When you have hemp and marijuana, it's like non-alcoholic beer and regular beer. Basically, industrial hemp, they've taken the THC out. It's so low, it's 0.3%. It's so low, you have to smoke a joint the size of a telephone pole to get high. I mean, literally, it's non-psychoactive. Where in cannabis, marijuana, the THC levels are anywhere from 10 to 25%. And the CBD levels in marijuana are below usually 0%, 0.2, 0.3. The last 30 or 40 years, most marijuana growers have bred the CBD out of marijuana because it brings your high down.
Okay, and marijuana, of course, the medicinal use, of course, I think is critical. It's been known to fight cancers, and we'll get into a little bit of that. But back to hemp for a second, Christopher. So what happened? I mean, it was widely used back in the 1900s, And then what happened?
Well, if you look at Popular Mechanics in 1937, a very, very popular magazine, the cover story was the new billion-dollar crop. And it was all about industrial hemp fabric, mm-hmm. the fuels, the plastics. It was the first time we had a billion-dollar agricultural product in this country. It was outlawed that same year it came out in Popular Mechanics. I mean, can you imagine if it was worth $1 billion in 1937 and we never outlawed it? What would it be worth today?
Oh, huge, huge. Huge. And, I mean, this was readily grown all over the United States?
Yeah, it was grown mostly in the Sun Belt. It was grown anywhere from, you know, Kentucky to Maine, California. You know, the industries were selective. You know, some grew for ropes, some grew for textiles, plastics. Even Henry Ford made a car out of hemp plastic.
Was it Hearst that got it outlawed because he wanted all his forestries turned into, you know, pressed and paper?
You know, there's a lot of conspiratorial issues with why it was outlawed, but definitely William Randolph Hearst and a man named Harry Asplinger. He was like the head of the narcotics division for, I think, 50 years from 1930 to about 1960. I mean, amazing. This guy was in office that long, and he was the crusader, and both these guys were renowned racists. And if you read the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act and you read some of the stuff that Harry Asplinger said and all of the sensational front page headlines with the Hearst newspapers about minorities smoking cannabis, going in and killing white families and getting your daughters pregnant, it was
jeez,
crazy. And yeah. He even took it a step further. Where it really upset him was the jazz music at the time, the swing music. He thought that was the downfall of America, just like people thought when rap music first came out. I mean, it's insane, but if you read the congressional testimonies and some of the stuff that they printed, I mean, clearly there was a conspiracy to basically snuff out swing jazz music. At one point, Harry Asplinger was going to arrest over 1,200 jazz musicians in the United States.
I remember back in 1997 when I was doing my Nighthawk show in St. Louis, a guy came, he was on my program, he had a hemp mobile, a car that ran with hemp oil as fuel. What's the legality or the illegality of hemp today? I mean, where does it stand legally?
Well, right now it's legal in the United States. The federal farm bill they passed here back in, I think, April or March, 2014 farm bill, there's a provision in there that calls for the legalization of industrial hemp in any state that already has industrial hemp laws. So currently there's about, I think, maybe 18 states that have industrial hemp laws on the books. Now, each state has their own set of rules for industrial hemp.
Okay, so let's assume this becomes widespread and that farmers can grow it. How do they use it? How will they be able to process it? And then where's the market for it?
Yes, well, what we have to do, we have to build up. We have to build the infrastructure. We have to build the processing mills, the fiber plants. We have to build the seed crushing plants where we can make the protein powder, the seed oil. We need the extractor plants to pull the CBD out of that plant. So there's a lot of investment, and it needs to be done in the rural communities of America. You know, these communities, these farming agricultural communities, I mean, they've been devastated. If you look at some of the agricultural areas, the unemployment rate is like triple the normal rate.
Right.
So this crop could really help kickstart, you know, the economy and the agricultural economy. We definitely need a new crop. Farmers need something they can make money on. And we need to build infrastructure in these rural communities.
All right, we're going to come back in a moment and talk with Christopher Boucher about hemp and what uses it could be used for. His website is cannavest.com. It's linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And then in our second hour, I'll just merely open up the phone lines, giving you an opportunity to talk with us about this. We'll also look at some interesting facts about cannabis and hemp. The world's changing, and it's changing fast, and we want to keep on top of it. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back to Coast with Christopher Boucher as we talk about hemp and also marijuana. What are the two distinct differences there, Christopher, between hemp and pot?
You know, and that's a good question. A lot of people want to know that. And the difference between the hemp and the marijuana is the hemp has 0.3% THC, not enough THC to get someone high, where marijuana has the high THC. They basically have taken the THC out of industrial hemp. And this way it can be grown all over the world. It's grown in Canada. It's grown in Europe. It's grown in China. So there's a big difference there. And the CBD, industrial hemp, is filled with CBD, where medical marijuana, most of it, the CBD, has been taken out over the last 30 or 40 years.
Ah, okay. And I'm a proponent in both. I think we need medical marijuana. I think it helps a lot of people who, one, can't take pharmaceutical prescription pain pills. And, of course, it's being, you know, it's being hailed as something that could be a fighter against cancer.
Oh, yeah. THC has many uses, especially when you consume it, when you actually eat it rather than smoke it. And now we're finding out with a lot of these marijuana studies that it's the CBD in marijuana that has all these benefits, whether it's a neuroprotectant, whether it's reducing anxiety, shrinking tumors. I mean, if you go to, gov.pub, there's quite a bit of information there that you can find on the internet. I mean, there's just so many studies that have come out in the last few years.
Let's talk about some of the facts of hemp and cannabis, too. Cannabis hemp, they say, was a legal tender. It was money in most of America, right, until the early 1800s?
Oh, yeah. You had to grow hemp for those ships to bring food and bring supplies across the ocean. So, I mean, that was the main force of commerce. As Thomas Jefferson once said, hemp is a first necessity to marine and commerce. And when you just look at how important we needed these ships to have hemp sails and hemp ropes and even hemp oakum so the ship wouldn't sink. They took tar and hemp pine, hemp Jeez. Fiber, and they lined the inside of the ship so it wouldn't sink.
April 15th, tax time. You say in the old days you could pay your taxes with hemp.
You sure could. It was in the first Jamestown colony. They actually made an order that anyone there had to grow hemp, and it was so important, you know, to the commerce. And we definitely needed for ropes and clothing, and it was used for medicine too. It had been used for medicine. I think it was the most prescribed medicine for 200 years.
You say there was a period that if you didn't grow it, you could be put in jail.
Yeah, in Massachusetts, in the original colonies, they had, if you were a landowner, you were obliged to grow, X amount square footage. I don't know what they called it back then, but you had to have your plot of hemp.
So how influential was the petroleum industry to squeeze out hemp?
Well, you can understand, up until the 20s, this country was a carbohydrate-based economy. Everything was made out of agricultural products, whether it was fuel, papers, and plastics. And by the 20s and 30s, where petroleum came in, pharmaceuticals, petroleum-based plastics, petroleum-based fuel.
Right.
So there was this big transition from a carbohydrate economy to a petroleum-based economy. And I think we're slowly starting to get back into a carbohydrate-based economy now that we know what the carbon sequestration, the environment, all these issues that are coming at us.
Are there other countries that are producing hemp, or was it just the United States at that time?
Oh, the whole world produced hemp for thousands and thousands of years. I mean, it's embedded in our language. The word canvas means cannabis. So every canvas painting was made out of marijuana fabric or hemp fabric. The word canopy, like a tent canopy, that's Polish. That means, that's cannabis. The word pajamas, pajima, in Korean, that means men's marijuana pants, pajima.
If you didn't wear it, you could smoke it, right?
Yes. I mean, linguistically speaking, it's in our language. There's probably 15 different towns and cities named after hemp. There's Hempstead, Texas, Hempstead, Arkansas, Hemp Hill. I mean, it goes on and on. So it was definitely part of our culture, and we named cities and towns after it.
I'm just amazed at how much it went away during this push with petroleum products. I mean, it was just, one, it was made illegal, correct?
Yeah, it was made illegal. They lumped it in with marijuana. It was the same thing back then. There was no difference back in the 20s and 30s, and it was always cannabis. It was always hemp. The word marijuana is a real racist slang word. It means like a Mari is female, and Juana is almost like a transvestite, because the when you would smoke it, basically Hearst would say you could turn into a hermaphrodite, which cannabis is a hermaphrodite plant. So it's a very strange word, and words back then were kind of like psychops. When you said something that was really strange, it could actually scare somebody.
Does the hemp plant, Christopher, look like the marijuana plant?
It looks like it, but it's grown completely different. When you grow hemp for like food or textiles, you grow, the seeds are about maybe 2 to 3 inches apart. So there's no branches. What happens is the plant goes straight up. That way you get a long stalk with no branches, where in medical marijuana and cannabis, where you have one plant and there's nothing around it for 10 or 20 feet, so it can bush out and spread out and get the leaves and the flowers.
How do you answer any criticism from people who say, you're endorsing drugs? What are you doing?
Yeah, well, we look at, when we talk about drugs, we're talking about the opiates, we're talking about all these synthetic
heroin, stuff like that.
Basically,
methamphetamine.
Our country right now with all these addictions, it's incredible. You know, I ask the doctors, why are you prescribing these medicines that you didn't prescribe, you know, 30, 40 years ago? Those are the drug dealers.
Yeah, probably, but they've got a license to do it.
Oh, and they're millionaires. I mean, when you're a doctor these days, you can become multi-millionaire. I don't think that was the case, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
I think they just nailed some doctor for writing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of prescriptions. I mean, just out of control, out of control, just unbelievable. So if they use hemp again in the economy, what would you recommend that it be used for? If then we'll get into some of the work you're doing with cannabis, but if you had just a blank slate, what would you use it for?
Right now, we're using it for CBD and also for hemp food. It's easy to extract. It's a medicine, and the farmer can get paid quite well on his farm. Our idea is to partner up with the farmers. That way, we can get an easy crop in, harvest it, process it. Right now, what we're trying to do cannabis is build the infrastructure. We need to build the fiber mills, the seed crushing mills, the textile mills. You know, these are missing elements where the farmer, when he grows his hemp crop, he needs to take it to a place where he can sell it.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Now, all the old, I guess, factories or machinery that used to do this back in the early days, it's just too old, I guess, right?
Oh, it's gone. They cut that stuff up and sold it for scrap metal and shipped it overseas. It's just there is no infrastructure really at this present time.
How expensive would it be to develop a hemp plant? I don't mean plant for the ground. I mean a plant that physically does what you're saying it needs to be done.
Well, that's a good factory. Question. The size of the plant depends on how many acres it's going to feed. Let's say you had 30,000 acres, you know, and you would process X amount of tonnage. So you would build the mill to that size. Of course, you know, you could, you know, have it expanded over time. But if you look at the Canadians, what they're doing, the Europeans, we can copy some of these models that are already in place.
I've come up with my theory of why oil then is so low. They want to crush the hemp farmers so they don't make it as a fuel.
That could be it. I think at the same time that it's more valuable as a food. Right now, it's one of the top-selling proteins in the natural products industry.
How would you eat it?
You mix it in with your smoothie or your shake. It's just like any other protein. It's made from the seed. The seed is crushed up. They extract the oil out, and what's left over is the seed meal, and they grind that up and make a nice powder, and it's being used by all the athletes, all the weightlifters just love it. I mean, you've got companies that are mixing it in their formulation. Even Joe Rogan, he's got one of the top-selling hemp protein brands out there. What's unique about it is the number one absorbing vegetable protein that we know of in the plant kingdom.
What does it taste like, Chris?
It actually tastes kind of nutty. It's got a good taste to it when you compare it to whey or soy. It's got a rich, full, nutty aroma. It's a very, very powerful seed in terms of being it's a superfood. It's one of the top superfoods that we know of.
And it doesn't affect you like caffeine would make you jittery or anything like that?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. It just gives you core energy. And what it does is the body recognizes it because it's an ancient protein. So the body recognizes it, it breaks it down, and the body doesn't have to use all that energy to process that protein into fuel.
So can it be sold around the country or just in the states that have legalized the manufacturing and the planting of hemp?
Oh, right now we import over $550 million worth of hemp products into the United States. The Canadians control about 99% of the hemp food market. If you go to Whole Foods or you go to Vitamin Shoppe,
right,
that's all Canadian hemp products, which should be American hemp products, which we're doing right now.
It's all legal in Canada?
It's completely it's legal in Canada. It's been legal since 1998.
Well, they're smart. They know what they're doing up there. By the way, they're listening to you now. We've got a huge
Canadian
audience.
Oh, yeah, my Canadian counterparts up there, they're just wondering how long their business is going to hold on, because once we start growing here in America, and as you know, Americans, I mean, we are entrepreneurs here, and you get a good crop and you build a good mill, people are going to support it. They're going to buy it. And like I said, it's one of the top-selling protein powders in the natural products space.
I mean, has any major company said, we're going to build these plants or we're going to build a couple of these processing plants and start doing this? Any commitments yet?
Well, our company, Canavest, we're a public company, and we have investment capital, and that's kind of where our space is. We're investing in the infrastructure. We're building up the supply chain. We're growing hemp in Kentucky right now. We've done some pilot studies with the Murray State University. Also for Wounded Warriors, we donated some seeds to those guys, which are actually called Growing Warriors, teaching the wounded veterans to get involved in agriculture, and they actually grew a field of hemp in Kentucky, and I believe part of it they're going to take and they're going to process the fiber by hand, the traditional way, the American way, and they're going to weave American flags.
That's cool. So, all right, so Canavest is a publicly held company. Is it a small company?
We are the largest probably producers in the world of CBD industrial hemp. We grow about 3,500 acres in Europe, and we have the CO2 process, the harvesting equipment. We kind of went in with the idea, if we can build a supply chain and we can get other companies to make products. We make our own products. If you go to our website, you'll see all the products we make. They're there just to show everybody that, hey, you can make a body care line, creams, lotions out of CBD. You can make, capsules and supplements and sprays. So we actually sell wholesale to many, many different businesses. I think there's probably over 60 or 70 small hemp-based businesses that we support, and we supply them the raw material.
Okay. A small company, just really about a year, year and a half ago, started kicking in with revenues, I see, right?
Yeah, last year we went online and it took us about a year to ramp up and build the infrastructure, and we went straight right to the market. Rather than, there's a lot of companies in the space that you're doing research and they've got IP and working on patents. We went right for the supply chain, right for the products, get it into the market and start creating, cash flow.
Jeez. Okay. So you're a publicly held company, you're on the market, you go through the SEC regulations and all that. So you're up there, you're pretty above board.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a strong stock. We definitely, we dot all our I's, cross our T's. I mean, hopefully we'll be on NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange in maybe the next 12, 24 months, who knows. But that's our goal. Our goal is to bring it to Wall Street.
Okay, so once you get up and running, let's say you get more capital, where would you start building some of these other plants?
Right now, we're investigating and we're involved in Kentucky. Right now, Kentucky has the most ideal political situation you could ever imagine for industrial hemp. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I was blown away what they did in Kentucky. The Department of Agriculture, the congressman, the senator, they sued the DEA back in June because you know, the federal government passed the industrial hemp laws, but the DEA jumped in and said, we're not going to let you import seeds. And immediately Rand Paul, Mitch McConnell, Mr. Comner, who's the head of the Department of Ag, they went into federal court and they sued the DEA, and they actually won. They got a restraining order, and we were able to get seeds into Kentucky. A lot of ours were seized, but we did get some in the meantime, but it was proactive. So from what I've seen, there's nobody here in California, Oregon, Washington that's going to go after the DEA and say, hey, we want our hemp seeds. We're going to grow hemp here. You know, people don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to ruffle anyone's feathers. But I guess in Kentucky, that's where the industry really started. They've always been the biggest grower in the country. So I think it was a historical thing, patriotic thing maybe. So it's just unbelievable, the partnerships that we have there.
How long does it take to grow a hemp plant, Christopher?
Well, that's a good question. You want to grow for textiles, you can grow it maybe 70 days. You want to grow it young, mature, so the fiber's soft. If you're going to grow for food or seed or protein powder, it's going to take maybe about 100 days, 110 days.
How tall does the plant get?
It can get up to 20 feet tall.
You're like a tree.
Oh, yeah. You know, back in 1914, the USDA did a study. It's called Bulletin 404, and it was 1 acre of hemp was equal to 4 acres of trees for paper production.
Wow. How big does the stem get?
It can get as big as your, you know, fist or your ankle. It gets pretty big, but that's a different variety. So what's happening now, we're trying to keep the plants shorter because the harvesting equipment, when you come in to get the seeds, all these combines,
you've got to be able to knock them down. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, tough to knock down. So we're breeding. We have breeding programs in place that we're trying to make it a little bit shorter, a little bit fatter, so we get more yields. You know, currently you get anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 pounds of seed an acre. And farmer can make some money.
How do you market yourself to a farmer to do this?
That's a good question. What we do is we have them believe that we are there to partner up with them, because that's your partner at the end of the day. You want that farmer to grow a good, solid crop. If he does something wrong, not enough fertilizer, not enough water, it might not come out right. You both lose.
Right. So, are you his market when he develops the product?
Yes. Well, yes. You basically, technically, you give a contract to the farmer before he grows. You give him a farm gate price of, you know, whatever, $1 a pound for seed, or, you know, 50 cents a pound for fiber, or, you know, for CBD, same thing. You just make sure that you negotiate the price before he grows. And after harvest, he processes it, brings it to the mill or delivers it to the factory. And that's kind of where you pay them.
So you've got Kentucky. What other states would you love to be in?
Oh, California. if you can imagine, in 1994, I grew an industrial hemp field with close to 1 million plants in Brawley, California, out in the Imperial Valley.
1 million plants?
Maybe three-quarters, you know. They were packed in pretty tight over 2 acres, and we were planting, you know, 2 inches on center. And there was quite a few plants there, and we thought that would be the premier place to grow it because there's sunlight almost 360 days a year out there. The water is the cheapest water probably in the country, so you can have a really good controlled production out there. And Imperial Valley, California, back in the 20s, was one of the top hemp-growing regions in the country.
Just amazing. When we come back from the break, I want to ask you about, you know, infestation of bugs or, you know, pesticides. Does anything harm it? We'll come back in a moment. We'll take phone calls as well with Christopher Boucher about cannabis, about hemp, next.